The title of this morning's teaching is The Exclusivity of Love. Now, in a lot of ways, exclusivity is bad, right? I mean, we've all had our share of being excluded. And usually when we think of being exclusive, we think in bad terms, like cliques, right? How many of you have ever been excluded by a clique? Okay. Those of you without your hands raised, you owe us an apology, all right? No, I'm sure you weren't in a clique or anything like that. And if you would have been, you would have been inclusive. In fact, you know, cliques, when you think about it, aren't completely bad in the sense that if there's a small group of people that are close to each other, you kind of refer to that as a clique. And it's okay so long as it's inclusive, right? And you're always looking, hey, yeah, come on, you know, be a part of us. That's how it's okay. But being exclusive and excluding people, that's not good. And so a lot of times we have that attitude and understand that for a lot of times, exclusivity is bad. But do you know that in some cases, being exclusive is absolutely essential, like marriage? I mean, you know, we take vows to love our spouses exclusively, don't we? One of the lines in the wedding vows that I usually use is, will you love her or him, and forsaking all others, live only to yourselves as long as you both shall live. And that's where the guy or the gal says, I do or I will, right? And to break those vows, we refer to that as adultery, right? Or cheating. And if you have ever been cheated on, you know how hurtful, how painful that is. Or if you know somebody that has, you know that it's an absolute heartbreaker. Down in Tucson, most of you know that I was an assistant pastor there for a lot of years, and the main thing that I did was counseling. And most of what I did was marriage counseling. And when you're serving in a fellowship of over 6,000 people, and you're the guy that's doing most of the counseling, you do a lot of counseling. And you do a lot of marriage counseling. And unfortunately, I have had to be there on the other side of the desk when a couple comes in where one of them have broken those vows, where one of them have cheated on the other. And their love wasn't exclusive. And invariably, you know, especially when it's the guy that has done the cheating, the gal will say something to her husband. I thought you loved me. And, you know, without exception, I think, the guy usually says, well, I do love you. That other woman, she didn't mean a thing to me. And my response always is, liar, liar, pants on fire. I don't say that, but I'm thinking that, okay? That's what I'm thinking inside of me. And I usually will try and point out to the guy, well, you know, that's not really correct. Because she did mean something to you. She meant enough to you to risk losing your wife. She meant enough to you to risk losing your children, your integrity, the respect of the others around you, your family members, friends, co-workers. She meant something. Yeah, maybe she didn't mean what your wife means to you, but she meant something. And have you ever thought that it might be possible to cheat on God? You ever think about that? That it is possible to be committing adultery against God? And that's a concept that, you know, for most of us, you go, what? Can you even do that? Is that something that's possible? I think a more important question would be, if you were cheating on God, would you want to know it? That's probably a more telling question as far as the answer that would come back. Would you really want to know it so that you could do something about it? I think today we're going to look at some things that God addresses in His Word to really make sure that we're not cheating on Him. Because as we're going to see, it is possible to commit adultery against God. Let's look now in 1 John chapter 2. Let's start in verse 15. It says, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Now, I think we need to look at a couple of those words there before we really look at what this whole thing says. In order to understand what it says, we need to understand what that word love is all about. We're all familiar with 1 Corinthians 13, right? The love chapter. And it's really the noun form of that word, agape, that is used in 1 Corinthians 13. But here, it's the verb form, agapeo, which means to love. When we're in 1 Corinthians 13, we get a definition. Really, it defines, describes what that thing called love is. But here, it really talks about what love does, what action it takes. It really means to the act of setting our affections on, or to desire, to pursue something. And that's what he's talking about here. And that's why this one translation is called the New Testament and Expanded Translation, words it this way. Stop considering the world precious with the result that you love it. Stop doing that, he's saying. And the world, you know, it's one of those things where when you become a Christian, we have our own little vernacular, don't we? We have our own little phrases and words and stuff like that. And when you come in and you don't understand Christianese, you look at that and go, world, huh? What? What's that mean? The world, the globe, the earth. Well, the Greek word here in the New Testament is the word cosmos, and it can be used in a lot of different ways. It can be used to speak of what we understand as the cosmos, the universe, the stars, the moon, everything out there. And in the Greek, though, it can also be used to speak of any kind of order, a system of order, or really it can even be used to talk about adornment in that way. In the New Testament, one of the ways that it's used, and it's used right here, is to speak of all of creation, really all of fallen creation, and its system, its order, and all that it has to offer. And so when we read here, not to love the world, that's what it's talking about. Not to love anything in this fallen creation, or anything within its system, and all that it has to offer. And we kind of get into that question here at this point, in this verse, that in fact it is possible to commit adultery against God. Because remember, the Bible tells us as Christians that we are the bride of Christ. And he says that if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. See, just as loving another other than your spouse really says to your spouse, you're not enough, I don't love you that much. When we love the things that are in the world, it's really saying the same thing to the Lord. It's saying that exact same thing to God. Because we are supposed to love Him, Jesus said, with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our mind, with all of our strength. And so to set our affections and to pursue the things that are in the world, really, it's like we're cheating on Him. In fact, James is pretty bold when he says in chapter 4, verse 4, adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever, therefore, wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. It's pretty strong language, huh? But he tells us right there that if we're pursuing the world, if we're in love with the world, that we are viewed by God as adulterers and adulteresses. I don't want to do that. I don't want to be that, and I don't think you do either. But see, that love that again, gets described in 1 Corinthians 13, it's that self-sacrificing love. It's that love that willingly gives of itself. And, you know, in that, it is right to give of ourselves, to pour ourselves out for our spouses, for our children, for the Lord. That's right, and it's proper for us to do that. And that's what we ought to be doing. But to the extent that you love something or someone else other than the Lord, it takes away from the one that we're supposed to be loving. And we have to understand that. And think about all the things that we give up when we love the things of the world. I mean, think about this. That we give up because we're pursuing stuff. Because we're pursuing the things of the world. We give up time with our spouse. We give up time with our kids. We give up time with our friends. We even give up time with God in pursuing those things, Lord. And in fact, even we give up both the time with God that He wants so much with us, but we also give up giving to God our time and our money. There have been so many times I have people come to me and say, you know, God has been speaking to me and really been laying on my heart. I need to start giving. I need to start tithing. I need to really start giving to the Lord. And I say, well, okay, do it. Don't let me stop you. You know? And then they say, but I can't. Really? I mean, you got a pretty good job. I know what you do for a living or whatever. I know you do pretty good. Yeah, but I got too many bills. And then you start talking to them. Well, really? What kind of bills? And you find out, well, you know, my motorcycle, my boat, my car, my house, or this and that, and truck and Jeep and all that kind of stuff. I'm still making payments on all those things. And man, I got a lot of payments and the credit cards are maxed out. And sometimes what I'll do with folks is say, well, okay, let's do this. Let's put on a sheet of paper and all of the stuff that you spend money on here and spend time on here and then God over here. And it becomes real apparent as to where their heart is. And when we are so tied up in pursuing the things of the world that we don't have that time or even the resources to give to the Lord's work, something's wrong there. And God would say, hey, look at this. Check this out. But really, what are you consumed by? What are you being a slave to? And unfortunately, a lot of people in this world today are slaves to stuff, slaves to the things of this world. To where once God works on their heart and say, hey, you know, I want to use you. I want you to be involved in this ministry or that ministry. Oh, I can't. Well, you know, I've got to work two jobs just to pay all my bills off. And, you know, it takes time there sometimes to get to that place where God wants you to be. But I love this old saying. I think it's great advice. A friend of mine is fond of saying it. He says, don't love nothing that can't love you back. I think that's real good advice. Because if it can't love you back, and folks, things of this world can't. Stuff can't love you back. I think it's a good rule of thumb there. Now, he goes on here in verse 16 and kind of defines what he's talking about as the things of the world. And as we're going to see, these things of the world that Satan uses to tempt us with are the very same things that he has used all the way from the beginning, all the way back in Genesis chapter 3 when he tempts Eve to eat of that forbidden fruit. He says here in verse 16, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. Just three things. You know, I've always said, Satan has a very small tackle box. There's just a few lures in there. But you know what? They're pretty effective, aren't they, on us? I mean, eventually, at some point, you know, like we talked about last week, you know, he'll present one of those things. Oh, wow, look at that. Yeah. And before you know it, we're hooked. And as last week, as we were kind of looking and comparing sin to mud, you know, that those lures come by and just one of those three things. And pretty soon, there we are. We're standing in the mud. And folks, we have to understand these things. The Bible tells us that we're not ignorant of his devices. God has given us everything that we need to know so that we can stay out of sin. God loves us. He cares for us. And when we are in sin, his love does not stop. But he doesn't want us to stay in sin. He wants us out of it. He wants us to that place where we are realizing the blessings that he has for us. And, you know, this word lust here, oftentimes we just think of it in a sexual connotation there. But it's more than that. It means a desire, a craving, a longing, and really a desire, craving, a longing for that which is forbidden, that which God has said no to. And when he talks about the lust of the flesh, it's really an inordinate desire to satisfy our fleshly appetites. And there are those appetites that we have that God has given to us that are right and they're good so long as they are taken care of, so long as they are fulfilled in the way that God has said taken care of. You know, we have a sex drive. We have a desire to not be hungry, to eat. You know, it's part of that which causes us to eat and we can continue to live. If you stop eating, well, you know, you're not going to be around for very long. Give you a couple of weeks and that's it, kind of thing. But when we start going outside of what God has provided for that, then we find ourselves in the same place back there in Genesis 3, verse 6, that Eve was. Remember where it says that the woman saw that the tree was good for food. See, that's that lust of the flesh. She saw that it was good for food. Man, that would taste good. Satan's like, oh, look at that. Oh, this will taste so good. It will satisfy you. It will fulfill you. Isn't that what he does today with so many different things to us? Oh, if you just had this, it will fulfill you. It will really satisfy you. But it's always a lie. And, you know, he had lied to her just before that. And we'll get into that for a bit. But really, he lies all the time. He's the father of lies, God says. And she was desiring to go beyond what God had provided. And remember, God had provided graciously, abundantly. There was only one tree that they couldn't eat. All the rest of them, he says, of every tree in the garden you may eat freely. There was no restrictions other than just that one tree that they couldn't eat from. But she saw, oh yeah, this would fulfill me. This would satisfy me. And so going beyond that which God had given. And to seek to fulfill that hunger with something that wasn't good. Now, the lust of the eyes, he says here. That's a strong desire for what we see, for what's taken in by the eyes. Like last week, we talked about those shiny or pretty things that Satan holds up in front of us. Ooh, yeah, wow. You know, it's really talking about covetousness here. When we see those things, we, oh man, yeah, that's oh, that is awesome. I need that. And with Eve back in the garden, she saw that it was pleasant to the eyes. Oh, it was very beautiful to her. That fruit, whatever it was, we don't know if it was an apple. It could have been a pomegranate. We don't know. You know, but she saw it, and it was pleasant to the eyes. Oh, that's some good-looking fruit right there. It's like when we go to the grocery store. I never understand my wife when we go to the grocery store. I go to the meat department, and there's steak. You know, like a ribeye. And I'm starting to slobber. Oh, yeah, this is great. Yeah, put a couple of those in there. We go to the fruit aisle, and she starts getting all happy. You know, oh, look at this fruit. Look, oh, it looks so good. I'm going, it's fruit. You know, that's not food. That's what food eats. You know, but she looks at that stuff, and it's beautiful to her. But see, this was one thing. It was the only thing that she wasn't supposed to eat. But she saw, oh, man, it was, yeah, it looked good. It was pleasant to the eyes. And really, that's probably something that we're bombarded with every day of our lives, especially if you have a TV. Right? And you think about all the ads out there. They are geared to get you to covet. They're geared to get you to be dissatisfied and discontent with whatever it is you have. You can have a car or a truck or whatever that's just a couple years old. But then they come out and say, can we know you got that? But this is so much better. Look, isn't this beautiful? Look at the lines on this. Look, this. Look at the dash on this. Look at, oh, you know, the old one. Oh, that was like, you know, shaped weird. Kind of, but this is beautiful. Could you see yourself in that thing? You need one of these. Yeah, I got to have one. Whether you can afford it or not, I got to have one. And that's the way the world is designed. The world is geared to get us to covet, to get us to be discontent. But, you know, remember what Paul said to Timothy in 1 Timothy 6, verse 6? He said, now godliness with contentment is great gain. It's great gain, folks. I mean, think of just the money you save by being content. You're not having to go and buy all the stuff, spend all the money and run your credit cards up. No, I'm content. I'm good. But he says, godliness with contentment is great gain. To be able to live before the Lord and live a godly life and be content in that, hey, that's awesome gain. That is great gain. You are miles ahead, not just saving the money, but you are saving yourself in so many areas there. But he also talks about here, one of the things of the world is the pride of life. Now, that's the boasting of what you have and or what you do. All been there before, haven't we? We have all stepped in that puddle of mud before, haven't we? You know, with Eve, she saw that it was desirable to make one wise. Oh, I could be wise. Yeah. See, she believed Satan's lie in the very verse before that. Genesis 3, verse 5, where he says, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good from evil. Oh, I want to be like God. I want my status to improve. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I want that. And so that pride of life. Yeah. Do you ever find yourself bragging about stuff you have? Yeah. Or even maybe your position, your education, your accomplishments. You ever find yourself doing that? Not even just coming out of your lips, though. But do you think it? Because in the heart is where God sees us. Have you ever had somebody say, hey, check out my new this or that? And you're thinking, yeah. You don't say, oh, that's nice. But you're thinking, yeah, but I got one better than that, man. I'm cooler than you are because mine's better than that. See, that's the pride of life. Well, I have this, I have that. And in your own eyes, you get lifted up kind of thing. And you think more of yourself than you ought to. But here's something. In bragging about whatever it is you are, you think you are, or you have, understand that when you brag about that, what you're doing is you're elevating whatever that is to a place of great worth in your eyes. And everybody should value this as much as I value that. And this is real special. This is something that, oh yeah, you wish you had this kind of thing. But remember what Jesus said in Matthew 6:21. He says, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. See, those worldly things, when you count them precious, when you count those things as valuable, well, your heart's going to follow those things. You don't want to fall into that kind of sin, then don't start thinking of those things as valuable, as precious and all that. Instead, Paul tells the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 10, verse 17, I'm going to read out the NIV, the nearly inspired version. He says, but let him who boasts, boast in the Lord. See, instead of boasting in yourself and what you have and what you think you are, boast in the Lord. Because when you start having that kind of an opinion about God, oh, he's awesome. You know, let me tell you about the Lord, man. Let me tell you about Jesus. He is so awesome. He's love. He's this. He's that. He's so cool. You put that kind of thinking in your mind. You start putting him up as precious and all that, putting him before your thought process as the ultimate. Well, then your heart's going to follow. And you'll be going after him. Where your treasure is, your heart will be also. So important for us to understand that. See, because all of the junk of the world, all those things of the world, he says here, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And understand who is behind that system. Who is behind that cosmos, that order, that system of government, of needing things and all that other kind of stuff. It's our enemy, folks. Three times in the Gospel of John, Jesus says that he refers to Satan as the ruler of this world. In 2 Corinthians 4:4, it refers to Satan as the god of this age. He's the ruler of this world. He's the god of this age by popular demand. Most people don't want to deny themselves. Most people don't want to love God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength like they ought to. Oh, they love stuff. They want to have stuff. And they want to be somebody. They want to have other people look at them as they are somebody. Kind of thing. And they buy into this whole deal. And so they, by popular demand, they're getting in line with the god of this age. He's the one that controls the system. In fact, as we're going to see in a few weeks in 1 John chapter 5, verse 19, it says that the whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one. See, they're under his sway. He is just leading them right along. And folks, Satan wants to use these things to destroy us. He wants to use the things of the world system, and all that it has in it, to rip us off, to crush us, to destroy us. And like we saw last week, and like I was just talking about before, we've all stepped in the mud before, right? We've all been distracted. We've all chased after those things and realized, man, I am messed up here. We've all been destroyed just a little bit. At least a little bit, because of our own following after those things of the world, haven't we? And I think all of us can look back in our lives and say, man, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Because I tried to pursue this, I tried to pursue that, and this is where it left me. You know, just like the lie in the garden, hey, this will satisfy you. This is, oh man, this will make you all you want to be. Those of us that have eaten of that fruit, that have chased after those things, you know, it doesn't satisfy. Maybe while it's in your mouth, but just about as soon as you swallow it, you're hungry again. It doesn't satisfy anymore. You've got to have more. And that's all part of his system. And we've also suffered from other people's love of the world and of worldly things, haven't we? I can't tell you how many people I've talked to that as adults, they can remember back their kids as they were kids being neglected because dad was pursuing the American dream. He was trying to get all that he could. And he was working two shifts and two jobs where he wanted a bigger house and a bigger car and all that kind of stuff. And so they were kind of left to fend for themselves. A lot of us have been there. And the thing is, folks, what we need to understand it, that hurts the kids. And it doesn't please God at all. Even on just the physical level of that, and not even talking about the spiritual. You know, the thing is, your kid isn't going to remember what year and model of car you had when he was sitting in the back seat. He'll remember, though, if he was sitting in the back seat and you were taking him camping, or if you were, taking him to, hamburger stand or something like that just to hang out and spend time with him. They'll remember that. But when they're old, they're not going to remember what year, make, model car you had, how cool it was, and all that kind of stuff. We need to think about these things. We need to really commit to not doing that kind of thing to ourselves or to the people around us, to those who God has said, I want you to love them. Now, finally, in verse 17, he says, and the world is passing away, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever. So understand that this world is passing away. Jesus is coming back. This world, its system, its order, those things in the world, everything that it has to offer is coming to an end. When the Lord comes back to rule and to reign on this earth, he's going to set up a kingdom where he will rule and reign with a rod of iron, it says. In other words, it'll be a righteous system, and those people that are here and populating the earth, they're going to be made to do what is right. That system that we are in right now will be completely done away with. It'll be wrapped up. When you think about pursuing all the stuff that is in the world, the things of the world, I always think about what this great philosopher friend of mine, who happens to drive a Peterbilt for a living, he has a saying when it comes to pursuing junk stuff and everything. He says, hey man, it's all junk. It just hasn't made it into the junkyard yet. And you know what? He's absolutely right. And whatever it is that you spend time polishing or pursuing, paying for and all that kind of stuff, eventually it's going to land in the junkyard. That kind of puts things into perspective, right? I think about it this way. The Lord is coming back. Where are you investing? Now, if somebody came up to you and said, hey, these are financially troubled times, and I have this company that it is something you really want to invest in. You should take all your money out from everything you got. You just hawk things and just come up with enough cash and put it into this company because you're getting in on the ground floor. And oh, man, this will be a great investment. And you think, well, really, huh? Yeah, yeah. And then if he was to say, but you know, they're doing a lot of things shady, and they're going to get busted here in about 3 or 4 weeks. You know, they're already being investigated, and all your money's going to be lost. It's kind of like a Bernie Madoff deal. Would you still invest in that? Would you go, oh, okay, well, here's my money, you know? Would you still do that? And you say, well, no way. That would be stupid. Well, folks, this world is passing away. Isn't it the same thing? Do you believe God that it's passing away? If it's passing away, why do you want to invest in it? Why do you want to get so tied into it? Because it is passing. It's going away. The Lord's coming back. And it's a bad investment. But he mentions here about doing the will of God. He says the junk, all the stuff that's in the world, the lust of it and all that, it's passing away. He says, but he who does the will of God abides forever. Well, what's the will of God? Jesus tells us, John 6:40, for my Father's will is that everyone who looks to the Son and believes in him shall have eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. When all the stuff, like we saw a couple weeks ago, it's all going to burn, fervent heat, great noise, it's going to melt, it's going to burn. When all that stuff's done, we're there. He says he will raise us up at the last day. We'll be there in our glorified bodies with the Lord. And we'll be with him for eternity. That's God's will. is that we would come to that place of saying, you know, I'm not going to trust in the things of the world. I'm not going to invest my time and my money and energy into the things of the world. But I'm going to believe you, God. I'm going to believe you. I'm going to trust you. I'm going to believe you, Jesus, that you died for my sins. That you care for me. And the things that you have for me in your word are good. And I'm going to believe you enough to do what you say. And will we do that? Well, he says, hey, eternal life. That's God's will for us. Folks, do we believe God enough to take these things that we have seen today and apply them into our lives, to end our love affair with the world and the things in the world? Do we believe God enough to do that? Or like James says in James 1:27, to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Do we believe God enough to do that? Well, if you do, let me tell you, God's grace, that unconditional love, the fact that He loves you just for the sake of loving you, that forgiveness that He has, and the strength that He has for us is available for us, for anyone who would commit to love Him, to commit to believe in Him and to trust in Him. That's available for us today. And so if today, if God has spoken to your heart, and you realize, man, I think that I have been committing spiritual adultery. I think I have been loving the things of the world too much. And God, I'm sorry for that. If that's you, then we're going to pray, and you just pray with me, and God will hear your heart, and He'll forgive you. Remember, we saw last week that if we confess our sin, He is faithful and just to forgive us our sin and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. And that's God's desire for us, that He would cleanse us and that we would be right and tight with Him all the days of our lives, and we'd be looking forward to His coming, and we wouldn't be tangled up and messed up in the things of the world. Let's stand up and pray.